Chapter 1 Bartimaeus. Times change. Once, long ago, I was second to none. I could whirl through the air on a wisp of cloud and churn up dust storms with my passing. I could slice through mountains, raise castles on pillars of glass, fell forests with a single breath. I carved temples from the sinews of the earth, and led armies against the legions of the dead, so that the harpers of a dozen lands played music in my memory, and the chroniclers of a dozen centuries scribbled down my exploits. Yes, I was Bartimaeus, cheetah quick, strong as a bull elephant, deadly as a striking crate. But that was then. And now... Well, right now, I was lying in the middle of a midnight road, flat on my back, and getting flatter. Why? Because on top of me was an upturned building. Its weight bore down. Muscles strained, tendons popped. Try as I might, I could not push free. In principle, there's nothing shameful about struggling when a building falls upon you. I've had such problems before. It's part of the job description. There was the time when a small section of Khufu's Great Pyramid collapsed upon me one moonless night during the 15th year of its construction. I was guarding the zone that my group was working on when several limestone blocks tumbled down from the top, transfixing me painfully by one of my extremities. Exactly how it happened was never resolved, though my suspicions were directed at my old chum Fakwal, who was working with a rival group on the opposite side. I made no outward complaint, but bided my time while my essence healed. Later, when Fakwal was returning across the western desert with some Nubian gold, I invoked a mild sandstorm, causing him to lose the treasure and incur the pharaoh's wrath. It took him a couple of years to sift all the pieces from the dunes. But it does help if the edifice in question is glamorous and large. And in this case, the fearsome construction that had been ripped from its foundations and hurled upon me from a great height was neither big nor sumptuous. It wasn't a temple wall or a granite obelisk. It wasn't the marbled roof of an emperor's palace. No. The object that was pinning me haplessly to the ground, like a butterfly on a collector's tray, was of 20th-century origin, and a very specific function. Oh, all right. It was a public lavatory. Quite sizable, mind, but even so. I was glad no harpers or chroniclers happened to be passing. In mitigation, I must report that the lavatory in question had concrete walls and a very thick iron roof, the cruel aura of which helped weaken my already feeble limbs. And there were doubtless various pipes and cisterns and desperately heavy taps inside, all adding to the total mass. But it was still a pretty poor show for a jinni of my stature to be squashed by it. In fact, the abject humiliation bothered me more than the crushing weight. All around me the water from the snapped and broken pipework trickled away mournfully into the gutters. Only my head projected free of one of the concrete walls. My body was entirely trapped. The obvious solution would have been to change form, into a wraith, say, or a swirl of smoke, and just drift clear. But there were two problems. One, I found it hard to change shape these days. Very hard, even at the best of times. Two, the considerable downward pressure would have blown my essence apart the moment I softened it to make the change. So much for the negatives. The good side was that I was unable to rejoin the battle that was taking place up and down the suburban street. It was a fairly low-key sort of battle, especially on the first plane. Nothing much could be seen. The house lights were all out. The electric street lamps had been tied in knots. The road was dark as an inkstone, a solid slab of black. A few stars shone coldly overhead. Once or twice, indistinct blue-green lights appeared and faded like explosions far off underwater. Things hotted up on the second plane, where two rival flocks of birds could be seen wheeling and swooping at each other, buffeting savagely with wings, beaks, claws, and tails. So Such loutish behaviour would have been reprehensible among seagulls or other down-market fowl. The fact that these were eagles made it all the more shocking. On the higher planes, the bird guises were discarded altogether, and the true shapes of the fighting djinn came into focus. Truer, anyway. At bottom, we are all alike in our seeping formlessness, but every spirit has a look that suits them, and which they use to represent themselves while on earth. Our essences are moulded into these personal shapes on the higher planes, while on the lower ones we adopt guises that are appropriate to the given situation. Listen, I'm sure I've told you all this before. Seen from this perspective, the night sky was veritably awash with rushing forms, contorted shapes, and sinister activity. Fair play was entirely disregarded. I saw one spiked knee go crunching into an opponent's belly, sending him spinning away behind a chimney to recover. Disgraceful. If I'd been up there, I'd have had no truck with that. I'd have kneed him first, then stuck a wingtip in his eye, while kicking his shin for good measure. Much more effective. The techniques of these young djinn were so inefficient it pained me. But I wasn't up there. I'd been put out of action. Now, if it had been an Afrit or Marid who'd done the damage, I could have lived with it. But it wasn't. In fact, my conqueror was none but a third-level djinni, the kind I could normally roll up in my pocket and smoke after dinner. I could still see her now from where I lay, her nimble feminine grace rather undermined by her pig's head and the long rake she clutched in her trotters. There she was, standing on a post-box, laying left and right with such brio that the government forces, of which I was nominally a part, backed off and left her well alone. She was a formidable customer, with experience in Japan, if her kimono was anything to go by. In truth, I'd been misled by her rustic appearance, and had ambled close without upping my shields. Before I knew it, there was a piercing oink, a blur of movement, and whump! She'd left me pinned in the road, too weary to break free. Little by little, however, my side was gaining the upper hand. See! Here strode Corma Codron, snapping off a lamppost and swinging it like a twig. There raced Hodge, loosing off a volley of poison darts. The enemy dwindled and began to adopt ever more fatalistic guises. I saw several large insects buzzing and dodging, one or two wisps twisting frantically, a couple of rats heading for the hills. Only the she-pig stubbornly maintained her original appearance. My colleagues surged forward. One beetle went down in a corkscrew cloud of smoke. A wisp was blown apart by a double detonation. The enemy fled. Even the pig realized the game was up. She leapt gracefully onto a porch, somersaulted up onto a roof, and vanished. The victorious djinn set off in hot pursuit. It was quiet in the street. Water trickled past my ears. From top knot to toes, my essence was one long ache. I gave a heartfelt sigh. "Dear me," a voice chuckled. "A damsel in distress." I should have mentioned that in contrast to all the centaurs and ogres at my side, I'd been wearing a human guise that night. It happened to be that of a girl. Slender, long dark hair, feisty expression. Not based on anybody in particular, of course. The speaker appeared around the edge of the public convenience and paused to sharpen a nail against a snaggy bit of pipe. No delicate guise for him. As usual, he was decked out as a one-eyed giant, with lumpy muscles and long blonde hair braided in a complex and faintly girly way. He wore a shapeless blue-grey smock that would have been considered hideous in a medieval fishing village. "A poor sweet damsel, too frail to pry herself free." The Cyclops considered one of his nails carefully. Finding it a little long, he bit at it savagely with his small, sharp teeth, and rounded it off against the pebble-dash wall of the lavatory. "Mind helping me up?" I inquired. The Cyclops looked up and down the empty road. "Better watch out, love," he said, leaning casually on the building so that its downward pressure increased. "There's dangerous characters abroad tonight. Djinn and foliots and naughty imps who might do you a mischief." "Can it, Ascobol?" I snarled. "You know full well it's me." The Cyclops's single eye batted becomingly under its layer of mascara.
"Bartimaeus," he said in wonder. "Can it possibly be? Surely the great Bartimaeus would not be so easily snared. You must be some imp or moolah, cheekily adopting his voice, and— But no, I am wrong. It is you."
He raised his eyebrow in an affectation of shock.
"Incredible! To think the noble Bartimaeus has come to this! The master will be sorely disappointed."
I summoned my last reserves of dignity. "All masters are temporary," I replied. "All humiliations likewise. I bide my time."
"Of course, of course!"
Ascobol swung his ape-like arms and did a little pirouette.
"Well spoken, Bartimaeus. You do not let your decline depress you. No matter that your great days are over, that you are now as redundant as a will-o'-the-wisp."
Will-o'-the-wisps. Small spirits who struggle to keep up with the times. Visible as flickering flames on the first plane, although revealed on others to be more like capering squid. Wisps were once employed by magicians to lure trespassers off remote paths into pits or quags. Cities changed all that. Urban wisps have now been forced into lurking over open manhole covers, to rather less effect.
"No matter that your task tomorrow is as likely to be damp dusting our master's bedroom as roaming free upon the air, you are an example to us all."
I smiled, showing my white teeth. "Ascobol," I said, "it is not I who have declined, but my adversaries. I have fought with Fakwal of Sparta, with Tlaloc of Tollan, with clever Chu of the Kalahari. Our conflicts split the earth, gouged rivers. I survived. Who is my enemy now? A knock-kneed cyclops in a skirt? When I get out from here, I don't see this new conflict lasting long." The Cyclops started back as if stung.
"Such cruel threats! You should be ashamed. We are on the same side, are we not? Doubtless you have good reasons for skulking out the fight under this restroom. Being polite, I will not trouble to inquire, though I may say that you lack your normal courtesy."
2 years' continual service has worn it all away," I said. "I am left irritable and jaded, with a perpetual itch in my essence that I cannot scratch, and that makes me dangerous, as you will shortly learn. Now, for the last time, Ascobol, get this off!" Well, there were a few more tuts and pouts, but my posturing had its effect. With a single shrug of his hairy shoulders, the Cyclops levered the lavatory up and off me, sending it clattering away onto the opposite pavement. A somewhat corrugated girl got unsteadily to her feet. "At last," I said. "You took your own sweet time about it." The Cyclops plucked a bit of debris from his smock.
"Sorry," he said, "but I was too busy winning the battle to help you out before. Still, all's well. Our master will be pleased. By my efforts, anyhow."
He glanced at me sidelong. Now that I was vertical, I had no intention of squabbling further. I considered the damage to the houses all around. Not too bad. A few broken roofs, smashed windows. The skirmish had been successfully contained. "A French lot?" I asked. The Cyclops shrugged, which was some feat, given that he lacked a neck.
"Maybe. Possibly the Czechs or Spanish. Who can tell? They're all nibbling at us nowadays.
Well, time presses, and I must check on the pursuit. I leave you to nurse your aches and pains, Bartimaeus.
Why not try peppermint tea or a chamomile foot bath, like other geriatrics? Adieu."
The Cyclops hitched up his skirts, and with a ponderous spring, launched himself into the air. Wings appeared on his back. With great ploughing strokes he drew away. He had all the grace of a filing cabinet, but at least he'd got the energy to fly. I hadn't. Not until I'd had a breather, anyhow. The dark-haired girl crept across to a broken square of chimney in a nearby garden. Slowly, with the gasps and gingerly movements of an invalid, she slumped down into a sitting position and cupped her head in her hands. She closed her eyes. Just a brief rest. 5 minutes would do. Time passed. Dawn came. The cold stars faded in the sky.